Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
I went back to research Cork in the 1970s, where I grew up myself at the same time. And I was shocked at how grim and unpromising and dark the place was. You know, there was so little opportunity. There was so little potential, so little promise. So Keane discovered the one thing that he could do and that he was really good at. And Keane came out of Cork in the 70s knowing he was going to have to scrap and fight for everything. And his whole career is that. And I think where he came out of shapes that.
Ireland has produced a lot of sporting greats, but none quite like the one that myself and author Dave Hannigan will be discussing at length on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Because Roy Keane is not just a footballer or a pundit or even a national obsession at this stage. He's practically a genre of Irish conversation unto himself. And he's someone that has been a big part of my career for many years. Obviously, he's been in Gift Grub. I've done the stage production of Ikeno and... lots more things. Had a number one song sung by him, a Christmas number one. I think I better leave right now. You may know writer and journalist Dave Hannigan from previous episodes of the show. His new book, We Need to Talk About Roy, takes a fresh and fascinating look at Keane. Not just the man himself, but what he tells us about Ireland, ambition, class, celebrity, masculinity, football, and indeed fame. And this isn't just a great piece of journalism. Dave is from roughly the same part of Cork as Roy. They are roughly the same age, and they even played against each other in football a few times. In this chat, Dave and I chat about Roy's early days in Cork, why Saipan still has such a huge grip on people, how Roy became such a huge media figure, and why he may actually be more culturally relevant now than he was even in his playing days.
I always felt that his career was much more akin to like the guy who left Ireland, maybe with a trade, went to England and built up a massive construction company. Remarkable stories, you know, remarkable characters. He always reminded me of one of them, like, because he was self-made, who became this one-man corporation or one-man industry. And that's what happened in Saipan. Like, the FAI and everybody else knew that McCarthy and Keane didn't get on, knew they were kind of, it was a powder keg waiting to go off. But we kind of, you know, we have this thing where we'll just go, I leave that over there. We'll just pretend, bury our heads in the sand. We'll pretend that this isn't going to happen. I think he's more famous today. 20 years after he last kicked the ball, he is a bigger celebrity than he was at the height of his fame. And his fame was playing for Manchester United when they were the biggest club in the world. So his fame is bigger than that, which is very difficult to understand.
Roy Keane is such a fascinating character, and I think you're going to love this conversation, which is coming up in just a couple of minutes' time. But did you know that this weekend sees Michael O'Leary's birthday? Not just any old birthday. He's 65 years of age. And you know what we found? Well, actually, it was sent into my contacts book. I don't know how I ended up on his contacts book, but it was sent in. It's a video message from him inviting people to his birthday for the weekend. Gotta listen to this. This is Michael O'Leary speaking. This weekend sees the auspicious occasion of my 65th birthday. Happy birthday to me. Happy birthday to me. Now, you are cordially invited to a party at my house to celebrate that birthday. Note, nothing is included. No cake, candles, refreshments or music. Guests can, however, avail of the above on a tiered pricing structure. They can select each additional party feature individually during the online booking process. This process, of course, incurs an administration fee of €13.50. For a €15 fee, you can get priority boarding to the party, and for an extra €20 fee, you can gain access to the party address itself, which is inside the house. Those outside the house, left outside, will only be charged €10. When you arrive at the party address, you will then board a coach and be transferred to the real party location, which is a mere 3.5 hours away. As a gesture of goodwill for my birthday, the chances of winning the €2 maximum prize on a Ryanair scratch card, which will be given out to guests, will be reduced from 15 billion to 1 to 13.5 billion to 1. Enjoy the party, shut up, and have a great time. And exclusive comedy every week on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And of course, you can contact me on the Mario Rosenstock podcast, mariorosenstock@gmail.com, if you want to contact me about anything. But first, before we meet our special guest, we'd like to introduce another special guest. I'd like to warmly welcome our new sponsor, Hum. Hum is a finance company based in Ireland with over 30 years experience globally. And we are absolutely delighted to have them on board here at the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Hum provides flexible payment solutions for customers for a wide range of retailers like IKEA, Harvey Norman, Easy Living Interiors, Easy Living Furniture and DID, just to name but a few. So whether you're buying a kitchen or thinking about a laptop or new TV, some nice new jewellery or clothing, whatever it might be, Hum is there to help you make those purchases and pay back in bite-sized, easy payments. Couldn't be easier. Hum is there for the big things in life and the little things in life. And we are delighted to have them as a partner here on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And thank you, Hum, for coming on board. Okay, let's cross straight over to the East Coast of the US and meet my special guest on this episode, Dave Hannigan. His new book is called We Need to Talk About Roy. And not only has he done a lot of research on Keno, he even played against him as a youth.
I did, yeah. In my youth, he's the exact same age as me. He's 9 months younger than me.
Yeah.
So I grew up in the same Cork as him. I ran into him on the playing fields of Cork, mostly on the soccer field where he played for Rockmull, this famous team in the city that won all before them. I played on teams that didn't win all before them and usually lost to Rockmull. So I watched him from a very young age. But of course, like, you know, you remember the names of good players that
yes.
you played against, but you don't, you know, you don't necessarily think any of them is going to go on to become, you know, a very successful and famous footballer. And then this cultural icon far beyond the game at this point.
I played a little bit of schoolboys football myself in Waterford, and exactly what you say is true. There was always the five or six players around town that you would know the name of, and they would be kind of held in legendary status. You know, they'd kind of have a mythology about them. There was one player in Waterford called Gary Code, and Code, of course, was a very famous name. Because his granduncle, or maybe his grandfather, was Paddy Code. And Paddy Code was a famous player who played for Ireland and played for Waterford and all that. And he was a legendary player. So you would have known this kind of name. Would Keane have been like that as a young player? Would people around town have known that this kid was good?
Absolutely. I mean, there would have been five players, maybe even six players on that team who were very special.
Mm.
I mean, that was about, you know, the best schoolboy soccer team of all time in Cork. And you know, a couple of the lads went to England before him. Alan O'Sullivan, this unbelievably gifted left winger. Paul McCarthy, this indomitable centre-half who did have a very successful career in the lower leagues in England. Played nearly 600 games across the lower divisions and died very tragically a few years back. But, you know, those two players, Damian Martin, Len Downey, Eric Hogan, you remember all of those players would have been famous in our circles. Like, we would have known when we were going to play them, we knew who they were and you know, what they stood for. And they were a year young. Most of them were a year younger than us. Keane was played in the year below us. So he was playing a year up and still dominating in that age group.
He was still dominating. And even though he was small.
Absolutely. I mean, and that was the knock on him. That was why people believed he did not go across to England, which, by the way, at that time, like, going to England was the big, I'm sure it was the same in Waterford, like trying to get to England in your mid-teens was everything. And Keane didn't go because the scouts didn't fancy the size of him. And that then actually turned out to be a lucky break for him, because when he did go, he was better prepared and ready and at a different time in his life physically, I think, and mentally, so that he could hit the ground running in a way he might not have had if he was 15 or 16 when he went across.
There was two types of good players when I was playing young, when I was playing 12, 13s and 14s. There was the player who you might just call a good player, and they were good because they had skills. And then there was the player who was just a foot taller than everybody else. And basically they used to just go hoof it down to him, and he would just run the length of the pitch and then launch it into the top corner. And nobody could catch him because he was just, do you know that player? Do you know that kind of thing?
Yeah.
And so, but he never became anything, because basically they all caught up with him. And as soon as they caught up with him, he was nobody. But Keane obviously was small. So that means he was not only playing superiorly at his own age, he was playing superiorly against people who were older, bigger and stronger than him. Why? What was it about him as a player?
Well, I think the player that he became was kind of in embryo on the fields of Cork, if that's not an awkward enough metaphor.
Yeah.
As in, like, he was the exact same player. winning the ball in midfield, more aggressive maybe in the other box. Like I remember him popping up in the penalty box a lot and scoring goals. Mm. In fact, he used to be in an in-house goal scoring competition with the centre forward at Rockmount, a guy called Len Downey. Mm. And that's how often he used to get forward. So he was very much the player that he became, but a little bit more of a goal threat playing schoolboys football than he yeah. was. You know, I mean, at Forest, he was more of a goal threat than he was at United. At United, he became more of a holding player, I think.
When we think about Keane as a player that pundits used to try to describe on the television, I don't think they did very much of a good job. Keane, I watched thousands of matches, hundreds of matches, and they'd go, oh, box to box, Keane is there. You know, I would say, what else? The leadership, you know, Roy Keane, the leadership, the aggression, you know, you won't leave Roy down. You know, Roy will be, you know, he's driving standards. But this is not talking about him as a player at all. I mean, it turns out that there's a couple of things about him as a player that were worth mentioning. I mean, one is his first touch and his ability on the ball, which is completely under-regarded, apparently. Two is his flat speed and his endurance speed, which they call box-to-box. But what it actually is, it's covering miles, and which nowadays they always go by. They go, oh, this player covered 11.9 kilometres. In those terms, Keane must have been covering 14 kilometres at times, I'd say. So as a player, he had gifts.
He had, and his passing is the one thing that I always felt was so underrated. He was an incredible passer of the ball, but his impact on the game in terms of his aggression and putting himself about is a lot of what the pundits saw. And they didn't see these incredibly sharp, incisive passes, you know, hitting at real speed, like the pace of the passing and the direction of it. And, you know, the famous stories about him, like telling players newly arrived at the club, we don't pass sideways, we pass forward, you know, but they're on YouTube. If somebody put together a collection a couple of years or a compilation of Keane's passing, and you're like, totally overlooked. Look, I could go on for hours about how overlooked he was in terms of these yeah. stupid individual awards in England, that he won Footballer of the Year once. You know, David Ginola beat him out in 99, you know, just tragedy, or, you know, tragic injustice. But, you know, I'm sure that didn't bother Keane, because, you know, he wasn't in it for that. But yeah, I think he was very, very underrated as a footballer. He was a much more all-round player than just like an aggressive central midfielder putting himself about. He had a lot of skills. You said it, his first touch, beautiful first touch.
Yeah. Let's try and go a little deeper though. I mean, this kid, this 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old teenager then, was obviously demonstrating, and you allude to it in your book, obviously he's demonstrating a desire and an bordering on an obsession. Do you have any idea? Have you had a thought about this? I'm sure you've tried to think about it, Dave. Where is this kind of stuff coming from?
Well, I think my thesis in the book is it comes from the environment that he was brought up in, like the Cork of... I mean, I went back to research Cork in the 1970s, where I grew up myself at the same time. Mm. And I was shocked at how grim and unpromising and black and white and just dark the place was. You know, there was so little opportunity, there was so little potential, so little promise. So Keane discovered the one thing that he could do and that he was really good at, and that it then became, you know, his potential path out, which, by the way, very difficult path to choose and a very often impossible path to navigate. But my point is, like, the place you come out of dictates, I think, how you approach the world. And Keane came out of Cork in the 70s knowing he was going to have to scrap and fight for everything. You know, being working class in Ireland in the 70s and 80s, you always felt like that everything was stacked against you. You know, everything was stacked against you. The government didn't care about you. You know, your schools were neglected, you know, by everybody, and you just really didn't have a chance. So if you were going to take a chance, you're going to have to fight bloody hard for it. And his whole career is that. Like, he gets chances that other people got too. But he took the chances, and, you know, and never relented. Once he got a grip on something, he would never relent. And I think, you know, where he came out of kind of shapes that. Like, I'm not a psychologist, but I think that's a driving force inside of you. If you don't grow up with anything, you're going to be desperate to get something.
Yeah, because this is where I don't know much about it, but a few people have told me stories. He didn't get it from his father. because his father seems to be a fairly laid back fella who, you know, was a bit of a character himself, who people used to have a laugh with. And he was very proud, very, very proud of Roy's achievements. But he liked himself as a character as well up in the local. And, you know, Morris Mossy was not Roy Keane Sr. He was Mossy Keane. But I do get the impression that maybe his mother was made of stern stuff.
Yeah, his mother didn't feature much in his public life, but there's one great quote from her where she's asked about a journalist, you know, about Roy coming from the ghetto. And it's like, that's how the question is posed. And she puts the journalist in her place by saying, he did not come from the ghetto. He came from a very fine working class neighborhood where we looked after each other. And, you know, she kind of points out that the world, that the he's not quite the cliche that we all, or journalists certainly tried to make him fit into in the early part of his career. So yeah, the mother is a very quiet character, holding the family together. You know, Roy Keane doesn't reveal much about his family life in his autobiographies. Mm. You know, he doesn't go into which is perfectly, you know, his right, whatever, his prerogative. But, you know, I think the stuff about Mossy is like, Mossy was a typical, was all too typical of a type of male in Cork in the 80s who struggled to find work. You know, if you did not have a set of skills, if you did not have a trade, if you did not have an education, which obviously was not available to working class generations up to like the early 70s, you did not have many prospects. And the factories were all closing. There was seasonal work available in factories, but that even dried up as the 80s wore on. So yeah, I mean, you know, his family knew the specter of unemployment well, as did every working class family across Cork City at that time.
Mm. There's that famous, I don't know if it's apocryphal, statement of him in one of the locals, like the Temple Acre or whatever. And, you know, he points down at his crotch and he goes, "See that, lads? 3.95 million. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, in the early days, especially, there was a lot of kind of off-color stories told and kind of, you know, tall tales spun about Mossy Keane. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of that was unfortunate. And, you know, I wouldn't be a fan of the genre, to put it like that.
Yeah. I wrote down a list of sportsmen here, and Irish sportsmen. Stephen Roach, Liam Brady, Padraig Harrington, sports people like Sonia O'Sullivan, Katie Taylor, Ken Doherty, even Conor McGregor. And, like, really none of them, albeit as great as some of them are, and beloved as some of them are, really none of them come into the halfpenny place when it talks about the fascination they hold over us in Ireland. Why are we so fascinated by him?
I think that his fame, right, his career, his entire career, like his professional career takes off in the 1990s. There's a number of things happening in the 1990s that are going to make him more famous and more of a subject, more of a character on the national landscape than any previous, like Liam Brady playing for Juventus, winning the Scudetto with Juventus. One of the most underrated things in Irish sporting history. But to go back to Keane, what's happening in the 1990s? Manchester United are making a comeback, you know, having been down for decades. They are the biggest club in Ireland. And they're going to get bigger. They're going to become the biggest club in the world. They're going to become a merchandising machine, a global brand. And Keane's career takes off while that's taking off, right? Sky Sports take over the Premier League, or the Premier League comes into being. Sky Sports invent a whole new way of covering the game with exaggeration and hyperbole, and every game is a classic. And that, so that changes how we look at football, and Roy Keane's career is taking off as Sky Sports has taken off. And then in Ireland, I think in the 1990s, Ireland became a tabloid nation. You know, there was a tabloid days. We'd always had tabloids, and the British tabloids had always sold very well in Ireland. But there was a tabloidization of Ireland in the 1990s, and Keane's fame takes off just as the tabloids take off. The Daily Star or the Irish Star, you know, becomes a big newspaper in Ireland in the 1990s. And then the British tabloids all bring out Irish editions to try and cash in on it. And now we have an Irish celebrity culture. And some of those celebrities are kind of fake, tuppence halfpenny celebrities. But Roy Keane was the best player on the most famous team on the planet, in the most hyped soccer league in the world. So, you know, you take all of that together and you can see why he is a character of fascination. Like, you know, he is the only guy that will have a satirical radio show just based upon his life.
That's
alone.
Right. That's right. I mean, I even noticed when I was flicking through the book, I mentioned a couple of times in it in regard with regards to, and correctly, by the way, you did. They were both right. The first time was in relation to Saipan and Shea Given's story, which I've checked out, and I checked out with Shea Given and everything. And it was through that story that it was a very tense moment in the airport, and Shea Given sticks on Radio Roy, and he basically goes, there's a moment of like absolute tension, and apparently Keane lifts his eyes then and has a little chuckle, and then that's basically permission to laugh has been granted. But that was following a very tense episode with Bertie Ahern and all this on the plane. Keane had not wanted his photograph being taken, and Bertie was turning it into a bit of a clown show on the way out to Tokyo, you know, a real Fianna Fáil sort of photo opportunity. And then the second one you talked about is the Radio Roy. And the Radio Roy was, Roy, we were getting so many stories about Roy in 1999 and early 2000 that I suggested to Ian Dempsey and Paul McLoone, why don't we just give Roy his own radio show? Because footballers now are becoming much, much more media savvy and media friendly. You know, this was pre-footballers having their own Instagram accounts or anything like that. But they were becoming more part of the media. They were becoming media commodities. You know, they were becoming media owners. They were becoming, you know, the first instances of owning your own brand and your own rights, your own copyright had already come into the public idea. So I said, why don't we just call it Radio Roy? And it really had a little, it really rolled off the tongue, the idea that Roy would be on the radio. But the real idea of Radio Roy was that he was on the radio because he was Roy Keane, but he was on the radio and his family were fucking mortified that he was on the radio. Because we love Roy, but not on the fucking radio, Roy. You're making a goal of yourself. And then it was exacerbated by the idea that I had heard through my friend Eamon Fitz in Today FM, who's a huge bars man, same Finn Bars, and a big Cork hurling guy.
Like myself, yeah.
Bars, yeah. And I went down and I did a bars actually thing there a couple of years ago, a fundraiser. But anyway, Fitz goes, he has a brother called Johnson. Johnson? I don't know anybody in Ireland who knows anybody in Ireland who has a name called Johnson. It's an impossible first name. You might see it as a, possibly as a black name in America somewhere. His name is Johnson. But not in Ireland and not in Cork and not in Mayfield. And so we used Johnson as the vehicle that he'd ring up and he'd be the, if you like, the voice of mortification. The old fella, there's gawk all over the console. Yeah, get off the radio, Roy. You're making a disgrace yourself, a goal yourself. So that was that. And we had lots and lots of fun. And then we turned Roy into a radio host, and we used all the sort of pillars of radio to have fun with him. You know, and so yeah, it was quite extraordinary. So both the times that you mentioned there were utterly true, and that's because he was such a huge character that we had to do something with him, Dave, that could actually ingest the amount of material that was coming out about him. I personally think that around the Saipan time, he went into a completely different league. Now, obviously, we know about Saipan, but I'll never forget the interview he gave to Tommy Gorman, because I was right over all that and concentrating cleverly, you know, keenly on it. And one of the things I remember coming out of it was how many women began to become interested in Roy Keane after that interview, because he appeared as a man, not in his shirt and boots, not as the sort of barbaric warrior, but as this kind of emotionally sad, emotionally affected human being, a man with his little dark green Diadora sweatshirt and his eyelashes. I noticed his eyelashes. He had long eyelashes. You know, he was kind of like almost pretty eyelashes. And the thing about him was he was far more handsome in the thing. You could
see
this
in the flesh.
In the flesh, in the sense that he was a man wearing a sweatshirt. And when you take that out of the pitch, you see how ruggedly handsome he is and how healthy he is and young. And I remember after that interview, the amount of women that had an interest in Roy Keane, and I think that catapulted him to even more national debate and argument.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Like, Well, it's extraordinary, the trajectory of his career, because I think he's more famous today, 20 years after he last kicked the ball. He is a bigger celebrity than he was at the height of his fame. And his fame was playing for Manchester United when they were the biggest club in the world. So his fame is bigger than that, which is very difficult to understand.
For what it's worth, not as easy for me to do anymore.
Is that because he's so prevalent, like because he's everywhere now?
No.
Or it's changed?
It's because he's so ironic. He is so self-aware and so ironic. Characters who make the best satire and comedy are characters who can't see it in themselves. So when Enda Kenny says to you, "My name is Enda Kenny and I'm a very serious person and I would never lie to you," you're going, "You're a fucking liar and you're not serious," right? So that's why we can make fun of you, right? When Bertie Ahern talks about, "I swear I didn't know where the money was and I won it on a horse," and he's crying, that's satire. Roy Keane is now doing everything, but he's doing it with a nod and a wink. He's playing a version of himself, which is the heightened version of himself, which means he is undercutting me. He's pulling my rug away.
Yeah. And so I can see that.
Yeah, so he's harder to do, Dave. He's harder to take the piss out of.
And I also think he's too available. Like, he's everywhere. Mm. You know, what can you come up with that he hasn't said? You know, you could work on a sketch and he could come up with something today that will go farther, faster than anything you produce, because he is a viral content creator.
Correct. I mean, years ago, we would have invented a sketch where we go, imagine if Roy Keane gets an Instagram account and he has a cute little fluffy dog. Right? Well, that's been done. He did it. So you can't follow that, you know. What do you think of his public persona?
The current public persona? I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating because it's an incredible evolution over a number of years into everything he said he didn't want to be. I'm not as hung up in it as some people are, because I mean, I'm the same age as him. We all change. Like, you reach your 50s, you're a different person than you were in your 20s. You have different interests and different priorities and different opportunities come your way that you may take that you wouldn't have taken before. I think at times it veers on parody. I mean, I think at times he's like a footballing Jeremy Clarkson, and the other two are like Richard Hammond and James May.
Yeah.
If you're a Top Gear person, you'll understand that. Or there's other times he's like Victor Meldrew, you know, shaking his fist, going on about leaf blowers and paddle and, you know, getting really worked up about really mundane things. And as you say, like, is that a persona now, or is that like he's really annoyed about going to parties because parties are overrated and, you know, all this stuff that he comes out with? But I think what I'm most fascinated about it is how much he reveals of himself. Like, you know, there are moments that are just cabaret, obviously, but then there's moments on the overlap where he's like producing the clip where he produced the photograph of his parents at Wembley, and he showed, you know, he teared up looking at them, like, because it was 30 years ago, and you know, time has passed and stuff like that. And, you know, I thought that was a very human moment, and he's brought out contracts and showed his contracts from back in the day.
That is fun.
It's like, And that's, to me, it's like, I could never, of all the things I could ever see him doing, I could never see him being as revelatory as that. And that's the other thing about our fascination with him. He did not make himself that available to the media, like around about the time that you were doing, you know, in the heyday of the Radio Roy stuff.
Mm.
Part of it was that he wasn't giving long sit-down interviews all the time. He'd do one or two a year. So he wasn't a constant public presence and constant media presence. So you know, there was rich,
correct, but
rich territory
filling
to be
in the
mined.
Gaps.
Exactly. Like he would kind of give, he'd come home and he would do this press thing for the Guide Dogs, which he did great work for and continues to do great work for all throughout his career.
Yeah.
And that would be his kind of address. That was his State of the Union.
It was.
Address,
that
if you
right
like.
Was. Yeah, that was the State of the Union. And I'll never forget the day we got the call from his people into our office, because we had never asked for him, never dreamed of it, because there was no point. Do you know what I mean? There's just, at that point, there was just no way. You wouldn't even reach out, do you know, because it would be laughable within the room to reach out. So it never even came into our mind to reach out. So that never even, would we ever? No, we didn't even, would we ever even talk about it? No. And then in this 2005, I think it was, this call came through from the press officer going, Roy would love to meet you. And you're going, like, first of all, I didn't believe it. I thought it was a crank call from Fitz upstairs or something. And so about what? Well, he's doing the guide dogs for the blind, and he likes your stuff, and he'd like to. What do you mean he likes the stuff? And it's, so it turns out he's a real fan of comedy, but also, more specifically, impressions. He's a real fan of comic impersonations. So he would have been a real fan of that kind of the Fast Show and Harry Enfield and Spitting Image and things like that. And he loves the taking the piss out of public characters, a very Cork thing. And so he would have been very Cork in that respect. And so, yeah, so that came about, and then met him. One, you know, recorder, big room. And my only thing was I started doing Roy Keane at him, not knowing if he'd just go, what the fuck are you doing? What do you think? What the fuck? Like, what are you doing? Right? And I thought this was my nightmare. I thought he'd just start going, sorry, who do you think you are and what are you doing? On the contrary, he started kind of playing along with it. And he kind of went along with me as being Roy Keane. Now, that takes a kind of an emotional jump from a human being to go, I know the guy is doing me, but I'm going to let him do me and pretend he is doing me and he is me and I'll be me as well. So he was Roy Keane to my Roy Keane. And it's after that day, I've thought about it a lot. And I went, he gets showbiz. Straight away, he got showbiz. And so that was the character that you see now. He gets showbiz, like, really, really, really well. And he's very quick and, you know, and that. But he understands showbiz, which is why he's so suited for all this world.
And he has comic timing, you know. I mean, you know more about that than I do, but, you know, he has real comic timing. The delivery of some of these lines, you know, seems to be not perfect.
It is. It is. You seem to have put a little bit of a nexus on Saipan. That Saipan was a moment whereby a lot of things came out about Roy Keane, but not Roy Keane, Ireland.
Yeah, here's what I think about Saipan. Like, it is fascinating for me because in my day job, I teach history. And in America, Saipan means something completely different.
Yeah.
To Ireland. So that's always kind of fascinated me. And in the chapter, I tried to revisit a little bit and show, you know, what the Battle of Saipan was actually about and how the Americans are still burying their dead from Saipan. And we're still picking over the entrails of Saipan ourselves. But my thing here was, it was a very Irish, the whole thing. And I covered the Irish team in the 1990s before I moved over here. And it was a very Irish situation, right? In that the manager of the team and the best player did not get on. And everybody in and around the organization knew that. And nobody did anything about it. And this had been going on for years. And I, as I said, it's like when you go to an Irish funeral, sometimes, you know, feuds come out, or it might be a wedding. There's a long simmering feud that nobody's addressed, or a fallout. And we've just all pretended it wasn't there and then it explodes. And that's what happened in Saipan. Like, the FBI and everybody else knew that McCarthy and Keane didn't get on, knew they were kind of, it was a powder keg waiting to go off. But we kind of, you know, we have this thing where we'll just go, I leave that over there. We'll just pretend, you know, I bury our heads in the sands. We'll pretend that this isn't going to happen. I mean, Keane, when he's missing the game before they go, not Quinn's testimonial, before they go to Saipan, he contacts Mick Byrne to say he won't be going to the game. Not the manager, like, he has a mediator, you know,
a mediator.
And it's like, if it was a corporation, like, and you're the CEO and the next most important person in the company, they wouldn't be calling somebody to say, you tell the boss this,
no,
because me and the boss don't talk. And, you know, and afterwards, you know, which I thought was funny, the FBI, like, let's get a consultant's report. It's pretty easy. Your best player and your manager have to talk to each other. Otherwise, things are eventually. And it was unfortunate, obviously, it happened when it did happen, but it was always going to happen. Like, if you ignore a problem, at some point, the problem is going to explode.
I mean, even during that time, you're just bringing my head back to sketches now, the odd sketch where we'd have to react very quickly to something. Mick would be on, I'd be on one line as Mick, and I'd be on another line as Roy, and Ian would be in the middle, and Ian would be chairing this, like, so Mick, what do you want to say?
You tell Roy that if he comes back.
Roy, he says if you come back. Okay, you tell Mick. So we were using Ian as the mediator. They wouldn't speak to each other. So Ian, it was a nice little comic device. So because Ian was right in the middle and he could say exactly back to them on radio what they had just said to him, and they could both hear what each other had said. So we used to do that as well, and it was a nice little thing. Was there anything? Did you see Saipan the movie?
I haven't seen the movie yet.
Right, no, either have I. Now it's getting a lot of flack from the generational players who basically say it is nothing like that happened at any stage during the thing. So,
well, it's a very difficult subject to cover because so much has been written about it by people who are involved, who all have their own, you know, interpretation of what happened. Mm. What fascinated me about it is it offered us a window into two things about Ireland. Firstly, the overreaction was, I've never, you know, I revisited it in the research and you're like, You can't tell me that really happened. And like people driving a hearse from Dundalk to Dublin, you know, getting a Garda escort around Dublin, people outside the FBI egging the FBI offices and, you know, all sorts of madness. That was one side of it, the collective kind of loss of perspective of the nation. But then when you go through the media coverage, we're a very sophisticated nation now because I'm reading stuff and it's like, Fintan O'Toole is quoting Heaney, right? He's quoting Heaney about it. Conor Cruz O'Brien, who I never saw writing about sport in his entire career. I could be wrong on that, but I never saw it. He's writing about it and he's quoting W.H. Auden. Somebody else is comparing Roy to Coriolanus. And I'm like, this is what a country. Like, when Roy Keane was born, 4% of people in Ireland had a college education. Here we are in 2002. And the whole, you know, the sophistication of the analysis of what went on really struck me as like, wow, we're a super well-read, educated, you know, Sophocles is being invoked and stuff. And you're like, wow, we are, on the one hand, collectively losing our mind. But on the other hand, we're really smart people like that. If you know, in a normal newspaper, this is the quality of analysis and comparison and, you know, being used to illustrate this or illustrate this situation.
It got sort of nutshelled into one little idea, and I'm not sure what you think about this idea. The idea that Keane represented a modern, thrusting, ambitious, we can go anywhere and do anything in Ireland if we really want to, and that the old Ireland, as represented by maybe the hierarchy and maybe Mick McCarthy even, was the idea of like, we'll just give it a lash, right? And so what do you think about that look at it?
I think there was an element of truth to that, but a lot of people said, oh, you know, Roy Keane is Celtic Tiger Ireland. Firstly, he never lived in Celtic Tiger Ireland, right? He left Ireland in 1990, very different country. I always felt that his career was much more akin to like the guy who left, you know, left Ireland, maybe with a trade, went to England and built up a massive construction company.
Exactly.
Ironically, which was the career path, ironically, of some of the guys he gets involved with in Sunderland later. Mm-hmm. But those self-made men, you know, like lads who went to England in the 60s and 70s and just became like property developers, having started off as a carpenter, you know, working for somebody else, built up these empires. Remarkable stories, you know, remarkable characters. He always reminded me of one of them, like, because he was self-made, you know, self-made man who became this kind of, you know, one man corporation or one man industry, if you like. So I think, you know, it was an obvious thing to compare him to the New Ireland of 2002, this kind of thrusting going forward. We don't care about anybody because that was his creed. But if you look at his own life, it's like, go to England, rise up in your chosen profession, and then come back and maybe be annoyed by the stuff in Ireland that hasn't changed fast enough for you.
No, you're so right about that. And sometimes, because we're blinkered, because it's hard for us to see outside of our own bubble, but one is tempted to see some of those people who went abroad, a large proportion of them relative to our population, who succeed so well in politics, in building, in America, in London, in Boston, the way they are able to, I'm trying, you know, it's more than hard work, because I understand the Irish are hard work, but they're hard drinkers as well. And they're hard, you know, I think they're great at wheedling their way into networks. And I think part of that is our I'm bullshitting here now, little Dave, but it is an honestly held opinion. It's part of, comes from our storytelling background. The ability to stand somewhere, speak, blabber, waffle, but tell a story whereby other people are listening to you. You kind of become a fulcrum in those instances.
Well, I think, and you know, when we go back to Keane, the performer today, like, you know, the pubs of Cork, well, I'm sure this is true of the pubs of other cities in Ireland too, like, competitive places, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you're on the
bar
still there, like,
big time.
It's a competitive environment. And I find even, you know, I'm over here a long time, I go back to Ireland and I could be in a pub and I'm off the pace in terms of the talking. Like, I can't really get up to speed with what some of,
yeah,
you know,
and it's quick.
The barbs, the insults, the put downs, so fast and, you know, instant stuff. Whereas I'm like, well, I've been in America a while. No, I'm not really able to compete with this level of
snap. No, because the irony levels, they are just, your irony bones aren't trained as much over in America.
No. And I, you know, I'm obviously out of shape now when it comes to competitive storytelling.
That's,
you know,
cool. Yeah.
I get up to speed after a couple of days back.
It's true.
You know, that first night, I'm always like, geez, I can't compete at this level anymore.
What did you learn, if anything, Dave? I mean, this is an interesting question for me to hear you answer. What did you learn anything that you didn't know? Did anything stand out to you that you go, I've learned something? If this isn't just me putting together my thoughts on Roy Keane and maybe juxtaposing it against the growth and the birth of modern Ireland and maybe having a fascinating look at that, I learned something maybe new. Did you learn anything new about Roy Keane?
Well, I mean, again, what do we really know? But I mean, what's my opinion? I guess, like, what do I think I learned? I think he loves, and I've written a lot about Muhammad Ali, obviously, and I think Muhammad Ali loved the oxygen of attention. And I think Roy Keane does too. And nothing wrong with that, by the way. I'm just saying, I think, contrary to his public persona for the first half of his career, or certainly for his playing career, I think he really enjoys this kind of the adulation, the attention, you know, the being center stage, the Klieg lights, if you want to use that kind of cliche. And I think he enjoys it. And I think that was something I realized as I kind of poured through interviews with him, you know, his performances on the various shows, and tracing a line like from the 90s right up to today, you can see at a certain point in his life, he realizes the power he has over the media, like that when he speaks, it's an event and it's something, and you can see him harnessing that. And I think today, that's the one thing I realized, and it was something I figured when I delved deeper into Ali, was, you know, they love this. And I think Keane loves it and he's enjoying it. And that's the person that we see on camera today is relishing the stage that has been afforded to him at this point in his life.
What about two more things, actually. Did you think about, I've always wondered about him and drink and this idea that, like, so from what I know, and I don't know much, but from what I know was, and he says it himself on the podcasts, you know, it was a heavy drinking culture. I mean, obviously Fergie did change it after Whiteside and Robson and McGrath and all that. But still, you were allowed to pick your moments. And when you picked your moments, you went hell for leather. And so Roy would often joke about that. And I think he was he obviously had a lot of energy for the drinking as well. Like a lot of them probably did. And masses of personal, physical energy to stay out all night and drink lots. And he used to come out to Cork about maybe the odd time and he'd go for the kebabs and he'd get a bit of hassle and he might get, you know, fellas coming up to him and all this sort of stuff. But he was definitely, obviously, he had a bit of a wild side to him. But he obviously decided at some stage, it's not working anymore. It's not working.
Yeah, and like that's, you know, there's a chapter on drink in the book and that's the toughest chapter to write. There's a very tough chapter to write because Keane has spoken very eloquently about drink, the damage it does, the dangers of it, how it impacted his life and career, but is adamant that he's not an alcoholic and is very, very, you know, wants to repeat that regularly in interviews throughout his career. And that's one side of it. And then the other side of it is he has the classic thing that I think we all have as Irish people is he loves to tell a story of the crazy thing he did when he was drunk. And like the hijinks we got up to, you know, when we were young and wild and drinking and stuff like that. And again, most of it to his, you know, to his credit is in his 20s. He was a young man in his 20s earning huge sums of money and playing a very high pressure sport and then going out partying afterwards, probably a little too much. And he realized that and he's spoken about that. But, you know, we all socialize differently in our 20s than we do as life gets on, you know. And but he, you know, if you look at the quotes from him, he is very eloquent about the dangers of drink. And there's an exchange, which I reproduce here in the book, between him and Ronnie O'Sullivan about like when you know when it's time to stop. And it's very, very powerful. And then his relationship with drink changes the same way that I think Ireland's relationship with drink has changed over the last decade or so. And, you know, like when I go home as an outsider and you see like the pubs are empty and the gyms are full.
Yes.
And you're like, this is the coffee, and there's a coffee shop on every corner. Yeah,
that's the keenification of Ireland right there, isn't it?
So, he has led the abstinence movement, give up the sauce, you know. But it is like he's like, I mean, the idea for the book is that he is the story of Ireland is the story of him. And I think, you know, in drink, we see that in particular, like Ireland's relationship has changed with it as he has. And you know, Ireland has been damaged by it as he has, you know.
That's interesting. That's a good point. Nicely made. Do you think he drinks anymore?
No. I don't think he drinks anymore. I don't think he's drunk for a long time.
Yeah, but that does hint at a compulsion
as he says, what's the famous quote? There's always a reason, or there's always an excuse to drink. If you're having a bad day, if you're having a good day, if you win a match, if you lose a match, you know, you're at a wedding, you're at a funeral. There's always an excuse, and that's one of the many fantastic quotes from him about how tempting drink is.
In the kind of the modern media, sort of circus around Keane that we're living in, it's hard to be critical of him. And very few people are. And there is no market for criticism of Keane. There's no buyers. And there isn't, because it's just not really, you know, you could do some criticism of Keane, but the shares would be very low price. The high shares are, isn't hilarious and ha 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 and look at the Sky ads and do your job. That's where the real money is. But I do have criticisms because like you, or at least attempted criticisms or devil's advocate type criticisms. Jump in if you can, right? But I'll just throw them out there. He's no Eamon Dunphy. And what I mean by that is Eamon Dunphy was a person from a lower middle class background in a deprived, utterly deprived background, who grew into a person, in my opinion, of huge intellectual curiosity. A person who was able to look around the world, write about things outside his own bubble, and comment on things as far away as socialist regimes in Chile, Argentina, the land of the disappeared, Sinn Féin, the Northern Ireland Troubles, Mary Robinson, Seamus Heaney, John Hume, space, board games, PlayStations, favelas. Eamon Dunphy can do anything intellectually like that. Roy Keane this is one of my criticisms, never seems to have veered away from the playground. The Ian Wrighty and the Nevilles. And remember that time we went out and we got Langers and bought a watch? For a man of such high intelligence, I wonder why he hasn't stretched himself as much.
I guess, I agree with you a lot about Dunphy, because apart from anything else, Dunphy wrote A Strange Kind of Glory, which is, I would say, one of the best books ever written about Manchester United, right? An incredible book about Matt Busby and United and United's history, and just an extraordinary book, right? But Dunphy's a unique individual, because self-educated, you know, and you either have that curiosity about the wider world or you don't. I mean, Keane is not a bookish character, you know, that's not... You know, somebody once said to me, I think he's written more books than he's read, which, you know, I don't know that to be true or untrue. But my point is, you know, you can't compare anybody to Dunphy, because that was unique. You know, Only a Game is one of the best books ever written about football. which Dunphy wrote with Peter Ball back in the 70s. You know, Dunphy is a unique individual.
He really
is. And with you know, let me just say, Eamon Dunphy gave one of my previous books the worst review I've ever received in my whole career.
Which book was it, Dave?
But it was a book called Boy Wonder about my, it was a memoir about growing up in Cork in the 70s and 80s. And
it's such a personal story, and he hammered it.
An absolute two-footed tackle.
Well, like, what would he say? None of this is true. I knew Dave Hannigan when he grew up, and he's a spoofer.
No, actually, I can quote the line. He said, because I still laugh about it. Well, I don't laugh, I cry. It was like a best man speech gone bad. That was a line, you know? So, And that's all by way of saying, I think Eamon Dunphy is unique. His career is unique. His, you know, the way he carved out this niche for himself. Like, there's nothing like him in the English game. You know, there's not like Keane. If you're talking about intellectual curiosity, Keane's musical taste might be, you know, the most interesting development.
Positively, you know, Fourth Street.
And, you know, Dylan, the Smiths, New Order, you know, which would be classic of anybody.
That would be
of
quite Cork, though. I mean, Cork would be quite hip and cool back then and that kind of thing, you know. You know, you've got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend. He listened to those lines, I'll tell you, and he knew what it was saying.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I think that's a very interesting thing. His interest in Dylan and his friendship with Johnny Marr now is a very, you know, these are quirky things. But like, you know, I don't think he's reading, you know, he's not interested. You can't be interested in what you're not interested in.
No, you know? I agree with you, but I'm not that obvious, Dave. I have a secret plan, you see, in my little questioning. First of all, that was very big of you to say that about Eamon Dunphy, and fair play to you. That makes you... you know, the bigger person in many ways, and even nice of you to bring it up. But the second thing I was getting at with Roy was, it was more deeply rooted in his lack of ambition for himself. And this pertains to football. And you kind of wonder, for somebody who's, now again, I'm being devil's advocate, so jump in whenever you want to. So this kind of, the idea that, like, for somebody who has such high standards and wants to improve so much, he seems to have not improved or shown any interest in learning are keeping up with even modern footballing management methods. They seem to be completely lost on him. In fact, he makes Sam Allardyce look like, Keith Andrews.
Yeah, I think he's a classic case of the player who had an intensity towards the game, right? When he played, as we've discussed, he had incredible ability, but he brought an intensity to the game. And then he gets into management and he realizes, oh, they're not going to care as much as I care.
Yes.
And it's a completely, the story of football is full of the best players who are terrible managers.
And full of the ideas of mediocre players who were great managers.
Who were great. And you know, the amazing thing about Ferguson, who obviously Keenan himself fell out afterwards, was his man management. You know, that Ferguson was able to maintain success across generations when the players' checks got so big that, like, telling them they'd get a win bonus, which was at the start of his career at Aberdeen, a win bonus probably changed the fella's week if he got it, to paying for fellas play for United who were earning six figures, regardless of whether they won, lost, or draw every week. You know, that for Ferguson to be able to get the best out of them, knowing that they were rich beyond their wildest dreams already, that was the greatness of Ferguson. No, Keane didn't have that. Like, he just didn't. He did, you know, if you look at the Sunderland job and you look at the Ipswich job, he didn't have it and he didn't want to find it. Like, you'd see stuff. He went to the All Blacks to study how they did things. I don't think he brought much back from that, or he certainly didn't apply it at Ipswich, or if he did, the players weren't buying it. But yeah, there is not a curiosity about, you know, getting better and you know, being more modern. And even his analysis of the game is very much rooted in the old tropes of they wanted it more, and, you know, show a bit of desire and they're not hungry enough and, you know, old-fashioned cliches. It's not, you know, they need to invert the fullbacks.
I've never seen him do a squiggle on the screen.
No, and I think, you know, the game, to be honest, the game... The Secret Footballer, I don't know if you ever read the Secret Footballer books, that taught me more about how much the game has changed in the last 20 years in terms of, you know, the tactical preparation and how players know where they're supposed to be at every specific moment of the game. Mm. And I've never seen that in the analysis offered by Keane of a game ever.
Finally, Dave, do you think, this is your own opinion now, but give me as strong as you can. Do you think he'll ever manage at any level again in his career?
Absolutely not.
No,
I could never see that. No, I could never see that, because I would think it would be too much of a stretch for him now, and it would be something really low down and gimmicky, and I can't see him doing that. You know, I think the ship, the last time Celtic came looking for him, you know, and they talked to him and they lowballed him and he just said no.
When was that?
That's it. I want to say, was he still with Ireland at that time?
Like, so 10 years ago?
Book. Yeah. And I'm like, because when he went to Celtic as a player, he took way less money to go play for Celtic.
Yeah, of course.
In 2005, 2006, than he did. He could have had much more lucrative destinations than Celtic. But no, I think, you know, there's talk about him. You know, I saw the story last week that he was in line for the Iceland job and stuff and back in the day. And I just don't see it. I don't see it, because it would be a club. It would be a struggling club without the resources and, you know, so far off Broadway. And I think he likes Broadway.
He does. Broadway.
I think he likes Broadway. He likes being on Broadway every week.
He does like being on Broadway. And we'll leave it there, Dave. This is the book, and it's Roy. We need to talk about Roy, the Keenification of Modern Ireland. And I've just been leafing through it, and it's great so far. So I'm going to start digging. I'm going to start with the chapter on drink. That's the one I'm really interested in, to see what you have to say about that. And thanks so much, Dave. We'll give it a good belt.
Thank you, Mario. Really appreciate it. Bye. Cheers. Good luck.
And my thanks to Dave Hannigan for joining me on the Mario Rosenstock podcast, for talking to me about, well, someone we know very well, Keno. And my big thanks as well to you, the listener, the most important element of this podcast. Please tell one other person if you enjoy this podcast. And of course, our new guest, Hum. Thank you for coming on board, our new sponsor. Hum is there, flexible payment solutions for customers for a wide range of retailers, big things, little things in life. Thank you, Hum. See you next week. Talk to you then.